This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Thank you all for coming out. It's very good to be here and good to see some of you whose faces are familiar. It's always interesting to me that we have the wonderful meditative support of this the 12-step group next door. They give us a nice reminder that meditation is not necessarily about being quiet, it's about being present. And Billy Collins has a wonderful description of it in a poem he entitled Meditation. And it's from one of his early books, The Rain in Portugal. I was sitting cross-legged one morning in our sunny new meditation room, wondering if it would be okay to invite our out-of-town guest to Frank's dinner party next weekend, when it occurred to me that I wasn't really meditating at all. In fact, I had never meditated in our sunny new meditation room. I had just sat cross-legged now and then for 15 or 20 minutes, worrying about one thing or another, how the world will end, or what to get Alice for her birthday. It would make more sense to rename the meditation room our new exercise room and replace all the candles, incense holders, and the little statues with the two 10-pound hand weights and a towel in case I broke into a sweat. Then I pictured the new room with nothing in it but a folded white towel and a pair of numbered hand weights, an image of such simplicity that the sustaining of it as I sat cross-legged under a tall window, my palms open weightlessly on my bare knees, made me wonder if I wasn't actually meditating for a moment then and there in our former meditation room, where the sun seemed to be brightening as it suffused with light the grain in the planks of the room's gleaming floor. Billy has a way of just making what's so really so. You know, the Buddha did not, unlike the founders of other what are now recognized as world religions, the Buddha did not set out to start a religion. He also never set out to be worshipped. What he focused on was practice, just the practice that you have come for tonight. He never pronounced himself as a god. He never wanted to be worshipped. In the Eastern tradition, it was appropriate to bow and pay respects to one another as well as to an honored teacher, but that was the extent of it. I'm reminded of a number of years ago. My mother passed away this Thanksgiving, and we were very close. She made it almost to 97, and she left us in her own bed with my help, so she had the kind of ending to her life that we would all aspire to. But I guess it was about 20 years ago. No, it was 15 years ago. I was going to the three-month retreat at IMS, Spirit Rock Sister Center in Western Massachusetts. And I swung through Charleston on my way to visit my mom, before I went away for 3 months of silence. And periodically during my visit, Thelma was her name, Thelma would say, "You know, the Buddha's not God." And I would say, "You're right, Mother. He never claimed to be." She was a good Christian. My father was a Southern Baptist minister. And I broke the chain of 9 generations of Southern Baptist minister. So that was the concept she had of Buddhism. And I would say, "You're right, Mother. He never claimed to be God. He just claimed to be a teacher." And a few hours later, "You know, the Buddha's not God." And I'm sometimes a little slow on the uptake. After about 3 times, I finally realized I needed to sit down and have a pretty good talk with my mom. And it must have gone very well, because she leaned in and she said, "I'm going to tell you something that I've never told anyone." And I was a bit taken aback, and I said, "Not even my father?" "Oh, no," she said. "I would never tell him." And I'm wondering, what in the world could this be? And she took a deep breath, and she looked at me, and she said, "I voted for John Kennedy." And I laughed, as you did, because I recalled, you wouldn't recall since you wouldn't have known, but you can guess that my father, as a Southern Baptist minister, was preaching that to vote for Kennedy was to vote for the Pope to be running our country. And so I was quite surprised that Mother had taken this step. And I said, "And you never told him?" "Oh, no," she said. "I've never told anybody. You're the first person I've ever told this." And she said, "Yes, I walked in that polling booth and I pulled a curtain closed and I pulled down that lever for Kennedy and I pulled the curtain open and I walked out and I stood straighter and I was so proud of myself." And I'm mistakenly thinking, "Oh, this must be where I get all my liberal tendencies." Actually, that was not a mistaken thought, because it was true. And I said, "So you voted for Kennedy because you liked his policies and what he stood for, as opposed to Nixon?" And she thought for a moment. She said, "No, I voted for him because he was so cute." So that story is important to me because partly I listened, and partly I listened to my mind. I had my assumptions about what my mom was thinking. I had my assumptions about why she voted for Kennedy and why she was telling me the story. So in those moments, I was not listening. I was listening to my mind. And unfortunately, that's generally what we call listening. And it's the reason our world is in the shape it's in, and certainly our country right now, the dearth of listening. So my talk tonight is an offering to all of us, to each of us, for the extraordinarily challenging meditative practice of true listening. And what is it? How would I go about that practice? There's a wonderful book that I recommend to you by a poet and author named Mark Nepo. You may have seen a book he did of daily meditation practice, daily meditations and poetry that's pretty much everywhere books are sold still. And this particular book that he wrote is called 7,000 Ways to Listen, Staying Close to What is Sacred. And in the beginning of that book, he describes a conversation he had with a linguist from Nigeria named Olusope Oyelarin. And he wrote that Oi Lauren said that he brought languages alive like tropical plants and spoke of them as rooted things that sprout and reach in all directions for the light. And Oi Lauren told him that there were known at that time 7,000 languages on earth. And Nepo took that to heart and realized that therefore there are 7,000 ways to listen. And that led to the title of his book. In a sutta of the Buddha's, the translation of which is the root of all things, the Buddha describes the ways our minds distort what we hear, our perceptions, our views, and the multiple ways we perceive that which is impermanent as permanent, that which brings about suffering or dukkha as that which will make us happy, and that which is not Daniel, but I perceive it as Daniel. The three kalesas, as he named them, the three fundamental ways in which our minds distort reality through each of these prisms. And he lists in that same sutta 24 ways we distort our views. I'm not going to go through all 24. It's very fine distinctions, but here's an idea of what they're like. She perceives the herd as the herd. Having perceived the herd as the herd, he convinces himself as the herd. He conceives of himself as the herd. So having perceived the herd as the herd, he perceives himself as what he's hearing. He delights in what he's heard and says, it's mine. That belongs to me. That's me. This is mine. This is what I am. This is who I am. And thereby, we construct this false sense of self, of who we are. So an example that hops into my mind is when I was initially diagnosed with cancer, a pretty serious form. Suddenly I saw myself as having cancer. And it took a while for me to distinguish that was the creation of a self named Daniel that had cancer, as opposed to cancer was something that was arising in my experience, something that I could perceive and hear as not Daniel. In a different sutta entitled The Simile of the Snake, the Buddha taught, she regards what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. That which is the self is the world. After death, I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. I shall endure as long as eternity. This is mine, this is I, this is myself. So you can hear in that the perceptions we have of afterlife and heaven and the way those of us who were raised in a Christian or Judaic tradition perceive of a life after this life in some glorious paradise where this self continues. This is, as the Buddha taught, the fundamental way that we distort life and the fundamental way that we separate ourselves from life and thereby create suffering. We perceive what we perceive as something about Daniel. When you speak, you're making reference to me, or you're not making reference to me. When you talk about something you believe in, if that's different from what I believe in, I feel attacked even if I don't express it. I feel separate from me, from you. If you look different from me, then you couldn't possibly be related to me. You could not be myself. You are therefore different. In so many ways, we create enormous suffering in the world. And look at our planet right now as it literally explodes with violence and conflict and strife with dictatorial rulers fighting each other and causing literally millions of people to kill themselves. So when we listen to our mind in its creation of a self called Daniel, a permanent self called Daniel, and a self that doesn't like to suffer, so wants to push suffering away, or push away people who Daniel perceives causes him suffering. When we look at the world in that way, we create the very deep separation that we are trying to avoid. We are headed to my hometown in central South Carolina on a road that leads in the opposite direction. We're never going to get there the way we're headed. So how would we get there? This is by a poet that you will recognize, entitled East Coker. You say I am repeating something I have said before. I shall say it again. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not, and what you do not know is the only thing you know. What you own is what you do not own, and where you are is where you are not. T.S. Eliot is eloquently describing the paradox at the heart of life. Everything that exists on this planet exists in a duality. There is always an opposite. We prefer one end of the opposite, and so we identify with that and we try to push away the other. And we can't, because the paradox is life. They both exist together. The fundamental source of our suffering. But that's a hard thing to know. So the answer is not to strive to know it. The answer is paradoxical, to become comfortable with not knowing. As we become comfortable with not knowing, we achieve a level of humility and presence that allows us to begin meditating. And fundamental to meditating, in my view, is listening. So we listen in ways that are not skillful. Because we listen to our mind and we take what our mind throws at us as our real, really important thoughts. we don't recognize that our thoughts are fully conditioned. And what do I mean by that? I mean, if we begin to pay close attention, we notice that we have getting up in the morning thoughts. And those thoughts are conditioned by the alarm clock going off or by the alarm clock not going off, by whether we have to get up early or we don't have to get up early, whether it's the weekend or vacation or whether it's a work day. Those circumstances condition our thoughts, but we have the belief that I, Daniel, am thinking these thoughts. When we listen without holding on to the reality of what thoughts are being spun by the conditions we're in, we begin to listen in an entirely different way. So take the example of when I did have cancer, and I'm getting a special treatment that by some wonderful serendipities had just been discovered for the kind of cancer I had. And it's the first weekend I'm in Marin General Hospital, and the very nice Scottish male nurse is preparing me to receive this treatment. And they had to get some aspect of my blood in some kind of equilibrium. I couldn't possibly explain it to you. And so they gave me some substance, and then they would take some blood and send it off and test it, and then they would come back and give me more of that substance or less of that substance, depending. And that took the better part of the day. And then he came in and happily announced that my blood was in the right place to get this new treatment. And he came back in the room, and he was literally wearing a hazmat suit. And he was holding a bag that had probably at least 4 or 5 layers of plastic around a liquid that they were going to shoot me up with. And he's got a hazmat suit on it, just holding the stuff in 5 layers of plastic. And I remember lying there thinking, wow, this is really a strange experience. And I had been meditating most of the day, thankfully, while I was waiting for this to happen. And so I was in a pretty clear frame of mind. And I was able to say, bring it on. Give it to me. And that's the way I held that treatment. Because I listened to what was happening right then in life as opposed to the story my mind was telling about it. Our meditation enables us to do that. I didn't do that because I have some special skill or knowledge or ability to listen in a more open way. I had learned through now going on 50 years of meditating that different conditions in my life spur different thoughts. I do not think thoughts. I believe sometimes I think thoughts, but I don't think thoughts. Neither do you. Thoughts arise from conditions. When you're hungry, you have hungry thoughts. When you're thirsty, you have thirsty thoughts. Your body spurs those thoughts so that it will get the nourishment you need. You're not thinking them. When you're lonely, you have lonely thoughts. When you're fearful, you have fearful thoughts. The conditions we're in generate our thoughts. So the first step in learning to listen to life in a skillful way is using our meditation practice to recognize that thoughts arise. How do we achieve that recognition? It's an experiential recognition. My telling it to you tonight is not going to cause you to believe it and live through it, with it. Meditating will have you see it and will condition your mind to thinking in that new way. Ah, here's my hungry thoughts arising. Ah, I know why I'm having this particular train of thoughts. I had a bad experience at work today. This is my worrying about work thoughts. Here they are. Howdy. I'm curious. What are you going to spin off for me tonight? So we begin to separate ourselves from the thinking process that conditions generate. That's what Eliot meant by, in order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. So we don't actually possess our thoughts, we believe we do, but in order to truly get it, we must dispossess those thoughts, let them go. The second aspect that's fundamental to really listening and being connected is listen from a connection to life. Now, how do we do something as weird sounding as that? Because I am connected to life, right? We're all connected to life. Here we are alive. We're here. How could we not be connected to life? Well, we're not connected to life because of our minds. Our minds constantly disconnect us from life. When things happen that we don't like, we check out. When someone says something that we don't like to hear, we go into a pattern. For some of us, it's becoming very quiet. For others of us, it's being very aggressive and angry. Others, we get sad, we disconnect. We go home and ruminate. We have our particular patterns where we disconnect from life. There was a time that I used to spend a lot of time fasting and meditating in the North Carolina mountains. I would drive up from Charleston and take a tent and no food and meditate and fast. I was determined to get it. I had no clue what I was doing. It didn't work. But it did cause something very interesting to occur. Those physical conditions somehow connected me more clearly to where I was. I wasn't distracted by just having eaten, so I was sleepy, or being busy preparing food, or any of those ways that we keep ourselves busy when we're out in the wilderness. So I got very quiet. My mind got very quiet, and I could hear beyond my ears. I discovered that I would know when someone was walking up the trail long before I heard them. And when I look back on that, I know that it arose from my being fully grounded and connected right where I was without distraction, just like at a long meditation retreat. In that moment, I allowed myself to be touched by life in a way that was different from what I was accustomed to. And this is what the great writer and rabbi Abraham Heschel described as attuning our own yearning to the lonely holiness of the world. Attuning our learning to the lonely holiness of the world. Lao Tzu said it, "Can you hold the door of your tent wide to the firmament? Can you open your house wide to life? Connect with life. Accept whatever is there. Not liking it, not disliking it, just this is here. This is what's happening right now. This is it. Now, it doesn't matter whether we accept it or not, because it's happening. And we have, even though we think we have control over things, we don't. So acknowledging that and accepting and being present is a fundamental aspect of listening, connecting with life. The third is listen to what is not said, to what we don't hear. Now that sounds pretty weird. How can we listen to what is not said and what we don't hear? This is a story of my very first criminal trial as public defender, the first public defender in Charleston County, South Carolina. This would have been in about 1974, late 74. And I went to a Ivy League law school. They didn't teach you how to be a trial lawyer. They didn't teach you how to be a criminal trial lawyer. For sure, they wanted you to be a business lawyer for executives and corporations. Not something I was interested in, but nobody in my family had gone to college at that point, let alone to law school. So I had no idea what lawyers did except Perry Mason and E.G. Marshall. And I liked what they did on TV. So I realized that I didn't know how to try a criminal case. They hadn't taught me that at Harvard. And so I bought F. Lee Bailey's books on trying a criminal case. I actually tried a criminal case with F. Lee Bailey a few years after this story, and he was a terrible trial lawyer. But his books was pretty good. And I'm reading this book about how to cross-examine. And I'm reading this part over and over again, and he keeps saying, never ask the ultimate question. And he described what the ultimate question was, and it's an elusive concept, but I think I have it. So fast forward a few days, and I'm cross-examining actually my very first witness in my very first criminal trial. And to my amazement, this witness is just going with me right down the merry path. Everything I needed her to say, she was saying. And I got really excited, and I said, and therefore my client is not guilty. And I went inside, oh shit, that's the ultimate question. And I was very quick, and I said, Your Honor, I object. And the judge laughed, the prosecutors laughed, and the prosecutor stood up and said, Your Honor, Mr. Bowling can't object to his own question. And the judge, laughing, said, Objection overruled. You're right, he can't object to his own question. In the meantime, in the laughter and the lawyers and the judge going back and forth, the witness had frozen and didn't answer my question. So I very quickly reframed the question, taking the ultimate out of it. And it worked. So looking back on that time, I realized that I initially had failed to hear what wasn't being said. I had failed to hear what wasn't being heard in the whole room. But then I heard it. When we're truly present, and I was present in that moment out of fear and pressure, but when we're truly present in meditation, when we deepen our practice even 5 and 10 minutes a day, whatever you can do and really do it, we begin to hear in a different way. So I'm speaking with my wife, and I hear her words, but I also hear what she's not saying. And my skill in responding to my wife is much higher in that circumstance. I talk to my boss, and I don't hear what he's trying to say, but I have a sense of what he's not saying or she's not saying. There's a way my body feels. There's a way I'm hearing something that's inchoate. And I can try it out by speaking what is not being said and what I'm not hearing. And when I get it, it lands. It shifts the nature of the conversation. I am connected to the other person in a way that brings connection, love, fulfillment, resolution, etc. Our practice can give us that. We have to, however, let go of certainty and listen from curiosity in order to achieve that. When I speak from what I know, it's all over. When I try to convince you of what I know, it's even worse. And when I try to convince myself, it gets really bad. So this idea of being open to what's not said, what's not heard, requires me to have a more expansive connection. It requires me to be really connected with you and really listening to the circumstances. Are we out in public? Are we shopping? Are we having a long overdue clearing conversation? Is it a group of people? What are the circumstances? How can I listen in a more connected, open-hearted, quiet way using my meditation practice? And finally, there's no one else to whom we listen, ever. There is no one else to whom we listen, ever. Everything we hear, I filter through Daniel. Daniel's mind interprets, hears, based on conditions. If I'm feeling good, if I'm feeling clear and awake, then I'm like I am now. If I'm ill, if I'm angry, if I'm emotionally upset, I don't hear. We're always listening first to ourselves. One of my favorite books, and it's a tiny little pamphlet, I commend it to you. It's entitled Sin Sing Ming, Verses on the Faith Mind, by the third Zen patriarch, Sin Stang. And this is the paradoxical quotation that I first read 1978, probably, so 40-something years ago. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just simply say when doubt arises, not to, T-W-O, not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. No matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. to come directly into harmony with this reality, just simply say when doubt arises, not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded, no matter where or when, enlightenment means entering this truth. I've taken a little territory on that. I'm confident I have not, there's more to go. So I'll offer you, number one, this is probably the most important, that's the wrong word. It's been the most essential of the Buddha's teachings for me to grapple with. In part because I'm so connected with the concept of the paradox. I'm so attuned to the fact that everything comes in a pair. Everything comes with an opposite. So when I hold myself apart and separate from you, I'm not even remotely listening to you. I'm only listening to me. You might be talking, but everything you're saying, I'm filtering. So I hear it from me, not from you. However, if I can open my heart enough to be in the reality of my connection with you, even though in that moment you and I may be exemplifying this fundamental paradox, this fundamental duality, and you're taking this side and I'm taking the opposite, even though we might be living that in that moment, if I let go of my separateness and say silently, not to, Daniel, not to, I shift and I can start to hear you. And then I can be open to connecting with you. And then I can be curious about what you're saying and ask you to explain it and ask you to help me understand it more fully, rather than pushing back on what you're saying with my own view. And to the degree that I do that, I deepen that connection, not just with you, but with life, because I'm bringing harmony into the situation. And life is fundamentally harmonious. Anytime life gets out of balance, it brings something to cause balance to occur, even though often it looks like destruction. That's life's way of bringing harmony again. And we're seeing that writ large with our climate crisis. Life will bring harmony. That's what life does. So can I learn to be connected with life such that my actions, my thoughts, my way of communicating and connecting with you is in harmony with the way life works? And the title of that process is Not To. Those who do not live in the single way, in the not to way, fail in both activity and passivity. So we fail when we do, and we fail when we don't do. We fail when we assert, and we fail when we deny. To deny the reality of things is to miss their reality. So to the degree that we see reality as one-sided, we're missing reality. Reality is always dualistic. It's always not two. To assert the emptiness of things is to miss their reality. So emptiness and reality are a paradox. What we see, we believe is real, and we're impacted by it. When we see that its nature is empty, we hold it differently. But that begs the question of how is its nature empty when it looks so real? Because everything that we can see and know is comprised of the three kalesas, the three fundamental characteristics of life. It's impermanent, and that's generally easy for us to see. We know that this is impermanent, but we don't live that way. We know that I am impermanent, I know that you are impermanent, but we don't live that way for damn sure. The second characteristic is dukkha. We know that everything in life is fundamentally grounded in suffering. Now that sounds like a really bleak statement. Why would that be? Because when we see anything in life as permanent, when it's impermanent, what do? We suffer. We try to grasp and hold on to things in life that we like, hoping that they're permanent, and we push away the things we don't like, happy that they're impermanent, but we're, in doing either of those things, we're caught in the paradox. And so we're way off out of harmony with life. When we can see and hold the impermanence and realize that as a result of that impermanence, everything gives rise to suffering, then the next place our mind goes is, oh my goodness, this is horrible. This is all about me. I'm suffering. I'm impermanent. Oh, shit. This is terrible. As soon as I make anything you say or do to me about Daniel, I suffer because it's impermanent and because Daniel is also impermanent. We grasp on ourself and our view of life in order to protect ourselves from the suffering we see all around us without recognizing that if we let go into not two, which means I'm connected with all of it, I'm connected from my heart with you, so I am impelled to help the suffering in the world without holding on to any belief that it's about me, that it's permanent, and that I can in any way, in any long-term way, alleviate the suffering in the world because suffering and life are coterminous. Being in this body is suffering. We all do. We all suffer in various ways. Having not two is my guidepost. Means that my heart is open enough that I am filled by my connection with you. So together, we can ride the waves of impermanence. We can support each other in our not-two-ness, in our connectedness. we can be kind and generous and caring for each other in our dukkha. And I can realize that anything you do or say that I take as being about me isn't. It's about you, and vice versa. So let's sit for a moment. Those who do not live in the single way fail in both activity and passivity, assertion and denial. To deny the reality of things is to miss their reality. To assert the emptiness of things is to miss their reality. The more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking, stop thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. Stop talking, stop thinking, in other words, meditate, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. Stop talking, stop thinking, in other words, meditate, and there is nothing we will not be able to know. Thank you all very much for your attentiveness and your presence. And as my Uncle Arthur would always say, keep it in the road now, you hear?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.